Hey, folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This week, it's the best of adventure stories. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Christopher Ryan, the author of Sex at Dawn and Civilized to Death. But before that, Jen Bosworth Ramirez, a writer and actor you can find at jenbosworthramirez.com. And here she is now with a story we call, by the very Andrew Lloyd Webberish title, Job Satisfaction in Paraguay?
Okay. All right. So, I'm half Colombian. And my mom was Colombian. She's dead. It's okay. But that's a different story. So I'm half Colombian. And when I was 16, I really wanted to go to Colombia. I was like, I want to connect with the motherland. I want to find my roots. And also, I had no friends. And I thought, well, maybe my Colombian relatives will like me. And so I went to my mom and I said, look, Mom, I want to go to Colombia this summer. And she said, there's no fucking way you're going to Colombia. It's dangerous and you'll get your legs blown off by a bomb. That's what she said. So I was dejected. But the next day she came back and I thought that she had reconsidered. She said, no, you're still not going to Colombia. But I've signed you up to give yellow fever vaccinations in Paraguay. What the fuck? I didn't even know that Paraguay was a country. I had no clue. So I said, real smart like, I don't even know where Paraguay is. I'm not going to Paraguay. And my mom was like, it's Paraguay or fat camp. And I was like, oh, I'm on my way to Paraguay. Here we go. So, we had a little training. And by a little training, I mean we gave injections to oranges filled with water. And we were like told about etiquette. I was like, okay, what does that mean? And they said, well, you cannot offend the host family ever. They're like, they may look different than you. They may not have as many things as you. Do not offend them. Okay, fine. Then they're like, there's one more thing. I was like, okay. Like, you have to wear skirts all the time. No pants, no shorts, no jeans, skirts. Okay, fine, I got it. So they drop me off, I kid you not, in the middle of the fucking country, and I'm 16 years old, and this woman comes to me, and she's like this little lady, and she's got no teeth, but you know, I'm trying not to judge, because they told us don't judge. Okay, fine, you've got no teeth. She's little, and she says, my name is Cynthia, and I'll be your mentor. And I'm like, yes, I'll have a mentor. And she's like promptly left. Like, fuck you, you're on your own. Okay, great. And I had this host family, and it consisted of this grandma, again with no teeth, her granddaughter, Olga, 11, you got it, no teeth. And I really was starting to wonder if maybe they needed like a dental hygiene program more than they needed yellow fever vaccinations. I mean, it was a problem. But I didn't know anything about dental hygiene either. So off I went. And Olga was 11 and she had freckles and reddish hair and she looked like a Chucky doll. Exactly, like a Paraguayan Chucky doll. And I was afraid of her, but I didn't want to judge her, so I went on my way. And every day I would trudge in my skirt to this clinic, which really was a shack. It had a chair and like a half busted ass refrigerator for my supplies, and I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I could have been giving them yellow fever for all I know, but they lined up, and part of the problem was too, my Spanish was shit, because my mom eliminated all Colombian from her DNA. I mean, she became an English teacher, she lost her accent, she checked Caucasian on every form, and I grew up thinking that everybody's mom spoke in Spanish when they were cussing somebody out. And that my mom just had a real good suntan all year round. I knew some swear words because she used to cuss at me. So I knew how to say, no me jodas, which means don't fuck with me. And the other thing that she used to say was, tú eres una hija de una puta negra. Which these guys know, it means you're, and my mom, I have no idea why she called me this, but she called me the daughter of a black whore. Which is fucked up because she's my mom. So, okay, so that's basically what's my Spanish. So I'm in real trouble. All right. So there I was in Paraguay with that vocabulary. And so after my shift was over, it was like 12 hours in the sun giving these. All right. I would trudge back home. And the problem was it was like 1,000 degrees. And I had to wear a skirt. And there was no Spanx at the time. And so my thighs would rub together. And I would get these welts. And they would be all sweaty. And so I'd have to walk like this. And the Paraguayans would call me the cripple. And so I didn't make any friends there either. It wasn't going well. So the one joy I had was every day after my shift, I would go to the bodega and I would buy this huge packet of stale-ass chocolate cookies and expired Marlboro cigarettes. I picked up smoking, and it was like my one joy with those cookies there. So every day I would go to the bodega and get those things. And one day after my shift, I waddled on home, and I went to my room, which really was just a mattress on the floor. Fine, no judgment. And I lifted up my mattress to get my money. All my money was gone. The Paraguayan money, the traveler's checks, all fucking gone. I was like, motherfucker, how am I gonna get my motherfucking cigarettes? Because if you're a smoker, you know, it's like, oh, no, I will have a cigarette. So I didn't know what to do, and then I thought about it, and I'm like, Olga smokes. She's only 11, but she has a worse habit than I have at this point. And I bet she took my money. And I was ready to go throttle her ass, but then I remembered, do not offend the host family. God, because if I throttled her, then I might be homeless and have to sleep in the clinic and I wouldn't have any cigarettes and cookies anyway. So I didn't know what to do, but then I remembered the mentor. She had mumbled some shit about if I had a problem to come see her, and I had a problem. So I found her, and she opened the door, and there she stood, the little lady. And I said, hello, in broken Spanish, mentor, I have no money. I need money. I need money to live. Can you help me? And I'm crying. And she says, I will help you. And I'm like, yes, I will help you. And she looks me up and down. And she says, come with me. And I'm like, I am saved. She's going to make Olga give me my money back. I'm going to get my cigarettes. And then I realized it was good that I was going to get my money back, because there was no way to get out of this crap hole town without any money. So this was going to be good. So we start walking, and we're walking in the opposite direction of Olga's house, my host family's house. And I'm like, well, I don't know what this is, but okay. So we're walking, it's real hot, and we get to the edge of the village, a place I had never been before. And there was like this military compound. And there were these dudes standing out front with semi-automatic weapons. Which wasn't that unusual. For some fucking reason in Paraguay, everybody has a semi-automatic weapon. It is not a hostile country. There is no problem there. I don't know why, but they had them. So these guys were standing in front of the compound, and the gate was shut, and the mentor said something in Spanish I couldn't quite grasp. And they looked at me, these guys, and they smiled, and they had teeth, which I found kind of comforting. And they smiled, and they opened the gate, and they looked me up and down, and they opened that gate, and so we walked through, and I noticed, as we passed through, the gate slammed shut and locked. I was like, okay, well, whatever, I'm gonna get my money back. So we walk, and the mentor's in front of me, and we come to this little shack-like clapboard house, and we enter, and there, standing, is what can best be described as a caricature of a Latin dictator. Like a big bristly mustache and even freaking aviator sunglasses, military hat. I was like, okay. Like a cross between a dictator and Ponch from Chips. You know the guy from Chips? Like a cross between those two. And I felt good because he seemed official. And he walked up to me. They had muttered something in Spanish, which I couldn't understand because fuck, my mother never spoke Spanish. And he comes up to me and he says, darling, I hear that you have a little money trouble. And I'm like, yes, sir, I have a problem. He's like, I will help you get money, my sweet. I'm like, yes. I said, thank you so much. He said, ha, how badly do you need this money? And I said, you know where this is going. And he's on board. And I'm like, I need it. I'm 16. I'm like, I really need it bad. And he's like, okay. And then he asked me to turn around, like spin around. And I'm like, okay, I don't know, maybe it's some fucking ritual. I have no idea. So I spin around. And then you guys, this is what I hear. Now, one thing about growing up in a household where there is some Spanish is that you learn to understand more than you can speak. So this is what I heard. The mentor says to the military guy, here she is. She's beautiful, no? And the military guy says, yes, she's a little plump. Fuck you. She's a little plump, but she's very beautiful. And the mentor says, the men, they will like her, no? And the military guy says, yes, yes, they will. They like plump women. And then she says, well, I'll need my finder's fee, though. Now, yeah, you got it, sir. I realized, I faded out a little bit, but then I realized what this gentleman just said. This mentor wasn't a mentor, she was a pimp. She was a pimp. And it hit me after I came to, you know, you kind of fade out when shit goes awry. I came to and I realized I'm being sold as a prostitute to the Paraguayan military. Now, I was like, how did this happen to me? And I was like, my fucking mom. That's how this fucking happened to me. Because her dumb ass didn't want me to go to Colombia. Now I'm stuck here in Paraguay where I'm gonna be a hoe for the whole military. And then I panicked, I really did. And I was like longing to be at fat camp, counting calories and like doing obstacle, you know, courses and shit. And I freaked out. I'm like, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna die here. No one knows I'm here. I'm gonna die. I'm only 16. This isn't fair. Why is this happening to me? I start to cry. But, you know, sometimes the mind does some cool ass shit. So in that moment, I had a memory. Like, boom, a memory came. And it was from grade school. And there was this girl in grade school, and her name was Allison Mauck. It's her real name. I'm sorry, I have to use it. Her name was Allison Mauck, and she was one of those real weird kids. But she did this thing before gym class. She hated gym class. And she did this thing before gym class to get out of gym class. And it worked. And so, you guys, I willed myself to pee my pants. Allison Mauck would fucking pee herself right before gym class, and she wouldn't have to play that fucking dodgeball. So I was like, okay, God. And at first, you know, you can't really just pee on cue unless you're wasted. I've had many of those, but this was not that. This was like, please, God, God of pee, God of urine, Jehovah, I don't care. Dear Dios, let me pee. I need to pee. And for a second, it didn't come. And then all of a sudden, I peed a river of pee right in front of the mentor and the military guy, and the pee ran down my welted thighs, and it ran down into my shoes and on the dirt floor and on their fucking shoes, and I'm crying and peeing and peeing and crying. And just like Allison Mauck, it fucking worked. It worked. That fucking mentor, her face, like, she, you know, she had no teeth, so it was like. And the military guy was just, he was like, you know, with teeth, but And then the mentor, she steps in and she goes, oh my God, sir, captain, I'm so sorry. I had no idea she was retarded. And he didn't say anything, he was just, and I had never been so happy to be called retarded in my life. And then she yanked me out of there. And I looked back and the dude is just still standing there. There's like piss on his shoes and he just looks horrified. And she grabs me and we go racing out past the dudes with the automatic weapons and I'm dripping and crying and running. And we go through the gate. They open the gate. Those dudes are like, what the fuck? But they just let us go. They let us go and we walk back and the mentor's in front of me and she's muttering swear words, which I can understand. And she's muttering them and we finally get to my fucking host house and I take off. I'm like, fuck this fucking country. Fuck you, mom. And she grabs me. And I'm like, oh my God. And I thought she was going to hit me in the face, but she didn't. She reached into her pants. She could wear fucking pants. You could wear pants in this country. I just couldn't. She reached into her pants and she pulled out some crumpled bills and she shoved them in my hand. And I ran. I took that money and I ran. I didn't even thank her. I didn't look at her. I just ran to the house and I got to my bedroom and there was Olga on my mattress reading my magazines. Wearing my Chicago Bulls hat. I didn't care. I ran to her and I said, Olga, I love you. I love you. What's mine is yours. And she looked at me like, well, like I was retarded. Here's the thing, you guys. Any place where you gotta piss yourself to get out of trouble is not a place to find your roots. It's a place to fucking run from. And I, shortly after that, I got home and I made some other dorky friends and I made roots in, there with those people. But every now and then, I kid you not, every now and then when I'm in a tricky situation where shit's about to go wrong, I have this little thing I say to myself and I feel a lot better and maybe you could use it when you feel bad. And it goes, when you're afraid, when you're in doubt, do not be troubled. Just let it out. Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. We're back.
I was on track to do a PhD at Oxford in literature and then be a tenured professor somewhere by the time I was 30. But I found a loophole in the student handbook that allowed me to skip my junior year of college and still graduate on time. So I skipped the year to save my parents' tuition money, and I went to Alaska. I hitchhiked from New York to Alaska. During that experience, I met so many amazing people that had no fucking clue who Nietzsche was or Joseph Conrad or Emerson or Thoreau or all these people that I was studying, the stuff that was so important to me. And I sort of looked back at my friends who were all these, you know, verified geniuses and realized they were sort of assholes and that I didn't really want to be like that. I mean, they were good to me. They were kind to me, but they would have been real assholes if any of these people had stumbled into their world. And here I was stumbling into this other world, and I was being welcomed and assisted, and people were taking me home and feeding me and letting me sleep on their sofa. And I was welcomed into their lives in a way that my friends wouldn't have welcomed other strangers into their lives. So I had this sort of midlife crisis at 20 and realized that I was going in the wrong direction. And so what I said was, until I'm 30, I'm not going to commit to anything. I'm just going to travel around the world, have adventures, and let life do what it will to me. I was just talking with a friend about that last night, actually, a guy who'd made a lot of money. We were talking about travel because he'd made a bunch of money and he said, now what do I do? I thought this would make me happy and instead I'm just lost. I was saying to him that the thing about money is money buys you comfort, but comfort is numbness. The meaning of life and the interesting things that happen in life, the surprises in life, are things that happen when you can't afford to be comfortable, when you're backpacking as opposed to flying on your private jet to a 5-star hotel. You know, that's when you meet the interesting people, when you're hitchhiking. Of course, you got to stand by the side of the road and deal with Jesus freaks and rapists, but you're going to meet some really interesting people along the way. And that's what you have to pay for it. And if you can avoid paying for it, most of us will avoid it. Most of us will opt for comfort. But that's a fatal mistake, because what protects you from inconvenience also removes you from life. When my life was so full of change because I was traveling, and again, I was marking the travel by full moons. Like, I remember in India, I was in Kashmir on Dal Lake in Srinagar, and it was a full moon. And I thought, okay, so let's see, I want to be at the Taj Mahal for the next full moon. So I, you know, went traveling, blah, blah, blah. A month later, I'm at the Taj Mahal for the next full moon. And I look back and say, that was a month? That feels like years. I think of all the people I've met, all the things I've seen, all the experiences, all the surprises, all the, it was just so much packed into that 1 month. And that's what gave me the sense that, like, the length of your life isn't measured in years. It's measured in experiences and friendships and surprises and discomforts. And, you know, that's what measures time, because time is a measure of change. So when this experience in Tikal happened, I was 27. It was the full moon of April in 1989. And my girlfriend Anna met me in Guadalajara, and then we traveled together from there. In fact, just a couple months before that, we had been at Monte Alban near Oaxaca, which is another amazing complex of ruins. We'd been there for a full moon, and I had some LSD with me, and we met some people in Oaxaca and invited them to join us. And 5 or 6 of us went up and spent the full moon night there, tripping and having a pretty bizarre experience there. So we decided to repeat the experience at Tikal. And one of the things that I very much respect about hallucinogens is their ability to remove cognitive filters. And I think that's why they're so important as teaching tools in many traditional societies, and probably why they're so forbidden in our society, you know, because they do tend to reveal truths that we spend all our energy and time trying to deny and avoid. They bring it right in your face. And so that can be terrifying for people who are very invested in their denial, or it can be extremely liberating for, you know, someone who just needs a nudge to sort of get through the fire and get out on the other side. So my relationship with hallucinogens in general, I felt, was very respectful, and I would take them in sacred places in order to absorb more of the experience of being in that place. You know, that was one of the things that I tried to use them for. And so that's why we use them there in Tikal, because it's this Mayan ruin. So it's a magical place. It's a fascinating place, full of all sorts of interesting energy. Just the feeling of being in the ruins of a massive city that has been, you know, just overtaken by jungle for the last 1,000 years or 1,500 years is, you know, wow. You know, it's like, imagine being in Manhattan 1,500 years after it's over. You know, it's like that, but even more so because it's jungle. Fabrizio and Solange didn't know that Anna and I were going to take the acid. and we never mentioned it to them. But we took the acid maybe an hour before we would be at the top of the temple so that we'd be tripping by the time we got up there, but we'd still be more or less reliable to, you know, climb over all the boulders and rocks and the roots and these pipe ladders that are drilled into the side of the temple. And we finally got up to the platform where people hang out, and you're above the tree line as well. So you're looking down at the lush jungle tree line below you, and you hear the howler monkeys. It was a little before dusk when we set off. So we got up there, and the moon starts to rise just as the sun's setting. And then above that was this huge bank of clouds, thick storm clouds. You could see rain falling in the distance, and the setting sun illuminated a rainbow in the rain that was falling in the distance. It's really beautiful. Anna and I are tripping pretty strong at this point, and Fabrizio and Solange said, yeah, we're going to go back to the campsite because it's just going to be dark up here for another 3 or 4 hours. And Anna and I weren't feeling like doing any walking at this point, so we said, yeah, we're just going to hang out here. You guys go ahead. But I went over to the edge of the ledge to hold a flashlight for them because they were going down this ladder that was probably 30 feet straight down the side of the temple. And then they got to the bottom of the ladder and said, okay, we'll see you back at the campsite. I said, yeah, okay, see you later. And I turned to step to go back to Anna, and that's when I felt this sting, this bite or something on my foot. And I shone the light down, and I saw this scorpion running up the wall. And then I looked on the wall, and there were others. There were 4 or 5 I saw just like, you know, slittering around on this wall. It's like, holy shit, this whole temple is covered with scorpions. And luckily, I didn't jump when it bit me, because if I had jumped, I would have gone over the ledge and I would have been dead for sure. It was 30 feet down to rock. And it stung me on my little toe. I was like an idiot. I was wearing sandals in the jungle, you know, real smart move there. And I went back to Anna, and I said to Anna, hey, I just got bit by a scorpion, you know, and be careful because they're all over the place here. She said, well, is that dangerous? And I said, I don't know. By this point, a lot of people had left, right? Because now it was pitch black. But there were these two guys sitting over on the ledge, and we walked over to them, and they were Italian, it turns out, didn't speak any English. But Anna spoke Spanish. She was Puerto Rican. She spoke Spanish so they could communicate. And she said to them, you know, do you guys know anything about scorpions? And my boyfriend just got bit. They said, no, what? No, well. And so these guys were involved in our situation suddenly. And while we're talking with them, this Guatemalan guy comes up the ladder. He's like a night guard. He's got this old bolt action rifle, you know. I have no idea what this guy is doing up there, like what he's going to shoot from the top of this temple in the jungle. Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, he's stationed there. So we go over to him, and Anna says to him in Spanish, do you know anything about the scorpions? Are they dangerous? And he says, sí, son letales. They're lethal. Anna immediately started crying, and the Italian guys were everyone was upset and going through their own individual reactions. And my feeling was I needed to get down from the temple because there was no way anyone could carry me down. You know, we'd come up this series of ladders and all sorts of very awkward climbing over roots and boulders, and this wasn't the sort of place where you'd get a helicopter coming in and airlifting you or something. We were days from the nearest hospital. So I initially just sort of felt I need to focus on getting myself down before this becomes impossible for me to move or something. Anna was very upset. From my perspective, inconveniently so, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I felt like I couldn't afford to really be very compassionate at that moment. I just felt like I need to do what I need to do. And so one of the Italian guys said, okay, look, I'll stay with Anna. You guys go ahead. for a while, I was sort of judgmental, honestly, of her not being more supportive or of not keeping her shit together more or whatever. But, you know, A, she was tripping. So, you know, you got to give her the benefit of the doubt there. And B, in later years, I look back and I said, you know, it's probably a lot harder to see someone you love dying than to die yourself. The thing she was thinking about how she's going to call my parents or your, you know, how she's going to deal with all this in many ways was probably more upsetting than the things I was thinking. I started going down the ladder and with this Italian guy and working our way down toward the jungle floor, probably took us 20 minutes or so to get all the way down. And I remember someone telling me there were some American archaeologists who were working there, investigating the temples and the ruins and stuff. And I thought if anyone's going to have an anti-venom, I didn't even know if there was an anti-venom, but if anyone would have it, it would be these American archaeologists. So I need to find them. So we finally got down to the floor. And by the time we got down to the floor, I could feel the poison running up my leg. It was like a burning chili pepper sensation running up along the bone of my leg. And when it got to the top of a muscle, it would freeze the muscle. So by the time we got down to the bottom, my leg was pretty much stiff all the way above the knee. So I was sort of, you know, dragging my leg along, and we're walking through this jungle. And I remember all these amazing glowing insects and centipedes and, you know, bugs that would just fly, you know, big bugs flying by, and they're all glowing in this iridescent green sort of light. Very strange experience of the jungle. And of course we got lost because there are no signs or anything. They're just pathways going from temple to temple. And that's when I had time to think about what I was going through. And that's, I mean, it was so strange because there I was walking with this Italian guy and I was saying what I believed to be my last words. And this guy didn't speak a word of English. You know, he didn't understand a word I was saying. And I remember he would like put his arm around me or, you know, touch my back or something. And I was crying part of the time. I don't remember. But I was laughing too because I remember thinking this is so funny. You know, I'm dying. I'm saying my last words to this guy who has no fucking clue what I'm talking about. And I've never seen his face because when we went over to talk to them, it was already pitch black. I didn't shine the flashlight in their faces. This whole thing happened without ever seeing his face. And I guess he'd never seen mine either. So we were walking through this darkness together, sharing this incredibly intimate moment. Complete strangers. Honestly, what I felt was anguish because of the pain my parents would have felt. My parents had been so generous and selfless in the way they accepted the crazy shit I was doing and the crazy risks I was taking with my life. And to give them, you know, a dead body in return didn't seem like the right way to do it. Once the poison got up to my hip, then my whole right leg was frozen. And then my tongue started to swell and my throat swelled. So I couldn't swallow. And I guess I was salivating a lot because I was spitting and my lips were all tingly and weird. But I was sort of disconnected from that. I was observing it. And I thought this is when the poison's going to get to my heart and lungs and that'll be when it's over. You know, if it's freezing my leg muscles and once it gets to my heart muscle, that's where it all ends. This is when I really arrived at this moment of peace where I looked at my life and I said, okay, I'm 27 years old. That's pretty young to be dying, but what a way to die. This is a cool fucking way to die. You know, my friends are going to hear about this and they're going to raise a glass and they're going to be smiles and there's going to be sadness, but it's going to be like, wow, that guy, you know, he had his fucking adventure. That's what he wanted. He had it. And he died doing what he loved. And yeah, and I've been around the world and I've loved beautiful, wonderful women, and they've loved me, and I've, you know, been paid lots of money to do silly jobs, and I had the courage to quit those jobs and go off and do what I wanted to do, and I've had a full life. From the moment I stopped being afraid to die, I felt peace, I felt happiness, and I even felt pride, I think. I was already looking at it like an incredible gift. But in the meantime, we're walking around trying to find these archaeologists. And we came out, and there's this little parking lot, and there was a Guatemalan kid there, maybe 14, 15 years old. And the Italian guy explained the situation to him, and the kid looked at me like, holy shit, oh my God. And so he said, come, come. And he took us to this little hut and banged on the door of the hut, and nobody answered. Bang, 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 bang. Finally, a light came on, and this guy opens the door, and he was like, obviously shit-faced, like drool on his face and everything. So he opened the door and let us in, and the kid said, this is the doctor. Now, he's no doctor. This guy was, you know, whatever, a medic, or I don't know what he was. But we went in, and he sat me down on a chair, and he looked at my foot where the scorpion had stung me, and he asked me to describe the scorpion to him. And I told him, yeah, it was 2.5, 3 inches, whatever, sort of a green-gray color. And he said, oh, no, no, this is alacrán, not scorpion. Apparently, there are different names for two different similar creatures that we would call in English scorpions. But in Spanish, escorpión in Guatemala is a very small red thing that will kill you. But the alacrán, which is a bigger gray-green thing, is sort of like a rattlesnake bite or something. It can fuck you up, but it won't necessarily kill you if you don't have heart problems or you're not old or a child or something. So he said, look, if you're still alive now, this bit you 2.5 hours ago, you've already passed the most dangerous point, you'll be okay. He gave me a pill, which must have been an aspirin or a Tylenol or something, and he scooped some water out of this bucket he had sitting there and gave it to me. And of course, I knew I'd been traveling a long time. You never drink water out of a bucket in the tropics, but this guy just told me I wasn't going to die. So I would have done anything he'd said, you know? So I took the pill, I drank the water, we thanked him, and then we went back to the campsite. Ana was at the campsite with Fabrizio and Solange, and they had some beer, and we drank the beer, and we told them the story, and oh my God, what a story. And by now the moon had come back out, but we were still under the canopy of the trees, so we could just see the moon through the trees, and I think we had a fire, and my tongue continued to tingle for days after that. My tongue and my lips were still tingling. Then we went to this place just maybe an hour south of Tikal. It was a ranch that had been bought by an American couple who adopted a few Guatemalan kids, and they converted the ranch into a guest house, traveler stop. The guy, his name was Michael Devine, the guy who owned it, was a really sweet, wonderful man. And one morning, maybe a week after we'd arrived, I woke up with a really bad headache behind my eyes. I went down for breakfast and I explained to Michael what I was feeling. And he looked at me, he said, man, I think you have hepatitis. And I did. I had hepatitis that I had caught from that fucking jungle doctor and his bucket of water. And I ended up staying there for about a month. I remember lying there and there was a bottle of water next to the bed and thinking, okay, I need some water. And for like 10 minutes, gathering the strength to reach out and grab the bottle of water. And then another 10 minutes to bring it back to my chest. And then another 10 to bring it up to my mouth. It was just like I had no energy at all. It was really intense. You know, I went through the process of dying without actually dying. What a gift. What an amazing gift. So it's almost like a vaccination, you know, where they give you a weakened strain of the virus so you can survive the real shit down the road. And so I kind of felt like that, like what a great gift, you know, and if a month with hepatitis is what I have to pay, so what? I'll pay it. Whatever I have to pay, I'll pay it. And ever since, I've looked at my life before that night and after that night. That's a separation point in my life where I feel that everything that's happened since then has been gravy. Everything from the full moon of April 1989 is extra.
This is Lord Huron behind me now, and we just heard from Chris Ryan, whose podcast, Tangentially Speaking, I have been on. It's a great conversation. Go check out that episode. It's from June of 2022. And that is all for the Best of Adventure Stories, number one. If you have a story about battling Mother Nature or escaping a knife-wielding maniac, or falling down an abandoned well, or meditating on Mount Olympus, or chasing a pickpocket, or getting lost in Alcatraz, or swimming to Cambodia, even though that one's already kind of been done. Everything you need to know about how to pitch us your story is at risk-show.com/submissions. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.